This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Theda Skocpol, who is the Victor S. Thomas Professor of Government and Sociology at Harvard University. And her two recent books are Obama and America's Political Future and The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism, written with Vanessa Williamson. Theda, welcome to Berkeley.
It's very nice to be here.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Detroit, Michigan. Grew up in an industrial town south of Detroit, Wyandotte, Michigan, where my father was a high school teacher of business education, my mother a homemaker. My grandparents on both sides also grew up in Michigan, western Michigan and Okemos.
And looking back, how do you think your family and especially your parents influenced your thinking about the world?
Well, my father, Alan Barron, loved American history, so I'm sure that I got some of my interest in America's past and American politics and the Civil War. He was a Civil War buff from him. My mother was a homemaker, and they both stressed the value of education, of course.
And was there a lot of discussion about political events and politics around the dinner table?
You know, my dad was the one who did that. I remember walking with him to junior high one day, and he explained to me Keynesian economics. So he explained how it works. So I learned early on that a family budget and a national budget are not the same thing. My mother not so much engaged in politics.
Mm-hmm. And any teachers or events that affected you before you went to college that pointed you in the direction of an interest in political sociology?
Well, I certainly loved my teachers. I was an all-A student, which was not a very popular thing for a girl in Michigan to be at that time, a young girl. When I got to college, I got involved in the civil rights movement, and that had a big impact. I went to Mississippi with a church-based program, and that's where I met my future husband, Bill Skocpol.
And what did you major in as an undergraduate? And then how did this political activism impact your education?
Well, I was a merit scholar at Michigan State University, which meant that I was invited very early to be part of the Honors College there. And that was a good thing because, for one thing, it let me meet very smart fellow students from all over the country. And it gave me freedom to put my courses together as I wanted. I majored in sociology, but partly because it was open. It would allow me to do lots of things. I studied French literature. I studied anthropology, just whatever I wanted. So I think that was a very important, that openness. And the other part of it was that it was the time of the Vietnam War and the civil rights struggles, and I got involved in protests and demonstrations and constructive activism in all those areas.
And what did you learn from that other than the issues themselves, you know, that the war was wrong and that civil rights needed to be
changed,
yeah.
Well, I learned the value of getting engaged with other people. I think the anti-war movement went over the edge, and I did not go with it when I went into violent protest. But the trip to Mississippi was formative because we It was a Methodist-sponsored student project where Michigan State students went to a black college, Rust College, and taught incoming freshmen English and math skills. So I learned kind of the marriage of civic activism and education, I think, from that.
What about the women's movement? How did that affect you?
By the time I got to graduate school, that was an important factor, and I remember getting together with other women in the sociology department at Harvard University to ask why it was that there were so many women students over the years, but none of them became professors. And so we definitely raised the issues, and I became one of the first women appointed to the sociology department at Harvard after I got my PhD.
And that was controversial. I mean, you were a pathbreaker there.
Well, I was a pathbreaker just being appointed, and then a few years later when I was denied tenure after winning all the top prizes in my discipline, I filed a grievance about that. Not a legal case, but a grievance. And that eventually resulted in my appointment to tenure at Harvard. That was certainly controversial, but I would say that the side of me that came out there was sheer stubbornness. I knew that I had done what needed to be done, and I simply hung in there and insisted on being treated equally.
Let's go back to your graduate school education. So you were in sociology, and who did you work under, and what was your dissertation on?
I ended up working with Barrington Moore, who's one of the giants of comparative historical political sociology. That was really extraordinary experience because he was a rigorous, a demanding teacher who asked you to write papers that actually compared big developments in different countries across hundreds of years of history. I ended up doing a PhD dissertation on the French, Russian, and Chinese revolutions, partly under his inspiration, but also at the urging of Daniel Bell and Seymour Martin Lipset. These are all giants in modern political sociology.
And that dissertation was turned into a book, which became a major work in the field.
Right. It was my first book, and it took a few years after the PhD, and it's still regularly read and sells quite a bit.
So this passion that you have, which is evident in that book, I'm not questioning its objectivity, but something is driving your focus on processes of political and social change. Talk a little about that.
Well, I believe that the social sciences should ask questions about real-world developments and try to answer them with a variety of kinds of research techniques. So I'm not one of these people who believes that you should just have a data set and mine it or just learn one technique of investigation and use that. I believe you should ask questions about change in the real world. The first questions I asked were about the roots and consequences of revolutions, and my answers are quite objective, and sometimes they don't satisfy political partisans or even what I might want to find. So I don't believe in ideological social science, but I believe in big question social science.
And that first book, which I looked at, really... It's eye-opening in the sense it brings added perspectives to engage the debate which was already ongoing.
Right. I almost always get involved in a question because I think it's an important question to answer about the world, but also because I think the previous answers were not adequate. So in the case of the Revolutions book, I just didn't believe that existing perspectives, either ideological or social science, were adequate. And I, of course, ended up finding out that revolutions that were considered liberal or communist all resulted in strengthening state authority and frustrating the desires of the liberal Democrats or the socialist Democrats that had started the revolutions in some ways. So that's one example, but another would be I got involved in the debate about civic engagement in America when I knew that it was important to understand what was happening to volunteerism and voluntary groups, but I didn't think my dear friend and colleagues Bob Putnam's answers were quite adequate, so I had some other hunches. And a lot of times I get my hunches out of reading history, noticing patterns. So I look at things big and over time, but I also get down into the nitty-grittiest of empirical details.
So if a student out there would be kind of interested in this way of thinking and this method of doing research, what is the best way for them to train for that and to develop skills to have this broader vision?
Well, I tell students, for one thing, you need to be passionate about the question you're answering. If you're just doing something out of duty or just because it's the latest squiggle in some obscure academic literature, you're not really going to be very motivated, and you're not going to have an easy time explaining to other people why your research is significant. But beyond that, I encourage methodological diversity. I mean, I think it's fine to combine quantitative research, statistical analysis with historical investigation. And in my latest work, I actually went out and talked with people face-to-face. So I'm a big believer in bringing to bear all the evidence you need to answer an important question about society, politics, and how they're changing.
What are the qualities of character that go with this kind of research? Because you really clearly have to question the status quo of thinking on a particular problem.
Yeah, it helps to be a little bit stubborn and a little bit willing to stick by your guns. I mean, I remember when I was a graduate student and I launched on the States and Social Revolutions PhD thesis, which was really too big a project for, you know, three revolutions over hundreds of years. That's too big a project for a PhD thesis. And I had people in my department saying it was, and you should drop it. And I stuck with it. Now, I had some professors who encouraged me to stick with it. So I think that it is important to have some support from your mentors. But on the other hand, I tell students, if you've got a sense that you've got an important question and a new way to go about answering it, don't easily give that up. Because really, each generation of scholars needs to do something different and bolder than the previous. If you're just repeating what your mentors did, it's boring.
Talk a little about creativity in your work processes. I mean, we've identified kind of the challenging or the questioning of conventional wisdom, then bringing all kinds of data together using different methodologies. Is that how the wow moment then comes to you?
Well, the wow moment is always in realizing that I have a new question to ask and a new angle to get at it. And that comes from being open to all kinds of things. I'll give you an example from my second big project, which resulted in the book Protecting Soldiers and Mothers. I had set out to write a book about the New Deal and the development of the American welfare state. That was what people thought was the American welfare state, you know, the Social Security and unemployment insurance created in the New Deal. And I decided, well, I better go back and read a little bit about what happened in the Progressive Era so I have some background. And I was reading a book by a man, Isaac Max Rubino, written in 1913. And he said, he was comparing the United States to other countries, and he said, the United States is actually spending more on old age pensions than Germany and England. And I thought to myself, what can he mean here? We all assume we didn't start till 1935. But he was a brilliant man. He was very empirical. So I looked into it. And he's the one who put me on to the Civil War pension system, which grew out of 19th century American politics and actually provided disability and old age pensions far more generous and far earlier than a lot of other countries. By following up on that and taking the question that came from that seriously, I developed an absolutely unique perspective on the development of social policy in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And this gets into, before we talk about the Tea Party book and then the Obama book, this gets into an interesting insight that emerges as I read your books, which is the reality and the truth that lies in that reality versus our ideas about what the reality is. So that in fact, America is a very conservative place where the ideology of conservatism is almost the default position, but people are, I think you say, they operate as liberals in a way.
Yes.
Talk a little about that, because it's fascinating.
Well, and you know, this I saw in the historical work I did, but it's also known to modern survey researchers. If you ask Americans, and I suspect this would be true at almost any era, do they believe in government or the free market? They'll say the free market. Do they believe in government or individualism? They'll say individual initiative. Those are genuine American values that I think almost all of us, and I know I include myself in that, hold. But if you ask Americans about all kinds of specific things government does to boost opportunity or ensure security, they support those by equally huge margins. So that's the idea, that Americans are philosophical liberalism, philosophical conservatives who talk in those terms, but are at the same time quite pragmatic liberals when it comes to what they concretely want government and the community to do to help boost opportunity and spread security for all.
So what that suggests is, as a researcher, your theory has to not only look at the philosophical assumptions of the place you're looking at, but also the reality.
Yeah, and also you have to be open to ironies and to contradictions and to not get into so much of social sciences based on the assumption that you can slap one paradigm on something. Well, that's not what political life is like at all. And all good things don't go together either. So if you have an evaluative perspective, you better be prepared to notice that some of the things you think are good also have some worrisome sides to them.
I'm curious to work the way you work. It would seem that the sense of the bigger picture doesn't just come from your own disciplines. It seems to be informed by history, and I guess the humanities, because that's the place where you find the bigger question sometime.
Yes, I don't have very much patience for purely philosophical discussions or purely theoretical discussions, but I always read history, and I have a sense of change over time, and that probably is what makes me distinctive as a sociologist and political scientist, that I've always been interested in change over time and suppressed possibilities and comparing the past to the present, comparing different countries, grappling with similar issues. I absolutely try to keep the big picture in mind at the same time that I'm really trying to nail down exactly what's happening with organized groups in particular. So I'm not in the clouds at all. Quite empirical.
Let's use your new book, The Tea Party, and I'll show that, to talk about your methodology, the problem you were addressing, and so on. So how did this book come about?
Well, it was a surprise book, and that's another thing I would always say to young scholars. If something comes along that you're intensely curious about, don't say, oh, I won't pursue that. When Obama was elected president, I assembled a group of younger and older sociologists and political scientists to track what happened in the first 2 years, to look at what this change-oriented president was trying to change and what happened and what kind of politics came out of his attempts. Well, you know, not long into Obama's presidency, it was pretty obvious that something called the Tea Party had emerged. And what was it? A lot of people were spending a lot of time trying to label it, either ideologically or as a social movement or a party or this or that. I was curious. And at the same time, my graduate student, Vanessa Williamson, was doing an empirical project where she was looking for social capital in the Tea Party and got to know the Tea Partiers in Massachusetts and went and observed some of their meetings. And at a certain point, we realized that the combination of the kind of looking at local meetings, talking to local activists, and trying to understand how this fit into the big picture of American politics in the 2009-2010 period was a fascinating project, and so we teamed up.
Mm-hmm. And the what was new about the methodology you were using here?
For me, what was new was the step that we took of trying to make sure that we went and observed local Tea Party meetings, not just in New England, but in Virginia and Arizona ultimately, and that we sat down for one-on-one open-ended interviews with grassroots Tea Party activists. Now, we had pulled together all the national surveys about what Tea Partiers were like, what they thought, what other Americans thought of them. We had pulled together electoral statistics. We'd looked at the media and its coverage of the Tea Party. all these kinds of things that you do to get the big picture of an emerging movement. We gathered information on the Tea Party funders, the groups funding Tea Party public events, in particular demonstrations. But we knew we wanted to talk to people because surveys will only take you so far. I mean, you can ask somebody, do you believe in government or not? And they'll say no. But what do they mean by that?
So how hard was it to get people to talk to you? Here you are, a quote, Harvard professor, close quotes.
Well, I really am a Harvard professor.
No, but in their eyes, the quotes were
right.
For them.
Well, a Harvard professor, and I fit the stereotypes that Tea Partiers would have, which is that I'm a liberal. Now I'm a New Deal liberal, as I put it. But you don't have to click very far on the internet to find out that I'm a publicly engaged analyst as well as an objective scholar. So, well, that's quite a story, actually. And it's another example of how you have to be prepared to go with opportunity. Now, Vanessa had already gotten to know the New England, the greater Boston Tea Party. And partly because they're in Massachusetts, I would say those Tea Party people are open to researchers. And the leader actually let Vanessa send out an email questionnaire. So we got an evidence that way. But we thought, nobody's going to believe us if we're just talking about Massachusetts. We weren't sure we would, you know, because do Tea Partiers think the same in Massachusetts as they do elsewhere? How to get to know Tea Partiers in other parts of the country? Well, you know, I started thinking, who do I know? What relatives do we have? We sent some cold emails to different parts of the country to see if people would respond, and Tea Partiers are very suspicious of university professors. In fact, they don't approve of them. So finally I realized, Theta, you know a Tea Partier. I had been making comments on the website, the Arena website at Politico, as a New Deal liberal. And every month or so, some angry white guy would write me an email. You communist Harvard professors who think you know everything and can tell real Americans what to do. Well, I always answer them. If they don't threaten violence, I answer. They don't expect that. And so in one case, a man named Peter Stevens in Gloucester, Virginia, we had struck up an email correspondence, gone back and forth, arguing political issues and sharing stories of our lives. I suddenly realized I know Peter. Peter's a member of the Peninsula Patriots in Gloucester, Virginia. Maybe. So I wrote to him, and I said, Peter, I'm a scholar. I'm not just arguing with you now, I'm a scholar. We're writing a book on the Tea Party. We already know that it helps to talk to Tea Partiers. I, you know, pressed a button by saying, we've already talked to them in Massachusetts. Would members of your group be willing to let us come and attend a meeting, sit down for confidential interviews? Well, Peter went off and asked the members of the Peninsula Patriots, and they debated it. We got to see them debating on their website, because it's a meetup website. Some would say, no, you can't trust liberal Harvard professors. Another said, well, we've got to tape all the interviews. And I said, well, fine, if you want to. I don't have the money to do that, but if you want to. And I told them the questions we were going to ask. Well, ultimately, they agreed. They invited us down, and we had a very productive more than a dozen interviews, as well as attending the meeting.
So what did you learn about the Tea Party? Who are they?
They're older, white, always conservative-minded people, people who have either voted Republican, and they vote Republican against Democrats, but some of them are very skeptical of the Republican Party itself. So some are libertarians. About half are also Christian conservatives. They are deeply worried about the country, where it is now and where it's going.
What surprised you most about them?
Well, it was very moving to sit down with the Tea Party people. We ultimately did it in two places, in Virginia and in Arizona, too. And they were, the ones who would agree to talk with us were hospitable and really just normal folks, frankly, middle class people. We know that Tea Partiers are slightly more educated and slightly more well-to-do than typical Americans, but that's mostly because they're older. They're in their 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. Old people are the ones who attend the meetings in almost all places. So I was surprised at their willingness to be hospitable to some degree, but I was also surprised at what they really meant by their anger about government. After all, a lot of people in their age group are collecting Social Security and Medicare benefits or veterans benefits, military veterans benefits. And people were perfectly willing to acknowledge that, yes, they were, and that they had earned those, just like all other Americans think that about those benefits. So what part of government are you angry about? Well, it helped to ask that and to listen, because it turns out they're angry about benefits for illegal immigrants who they're convinced are getting health care and education benefits at their expense. They're angry about lower-income people who haven't earned it, asking for welfare, and many of these people don't realize welfare has changed. They haven't absorbed that at all. You have to work for welfare now. You don't just get it. And they were upset about young people, and that was the biggest surprise, because so many of the people we talked with raised the example of their own grandchildren or grandnieces or nephews who they said wanted something for nothing, who were coming home to live or asking for student loans or maybe using food stamps. We realized at a certain point that these older people didn't understand why these youngsters were having a harder time getting a foothold in today's economy. And, of course, they often don't approve of their moral views either. The fact that young people tend to be more tolerant, tend to be not against gay marriage, tend to be for Obama. So they were angry at younger people, too. And that did surprise us. We wouldn't have learned that except for the face-to-face interviews.
And bottom line here, and you emphasize in the book, it's really the other who they can't tolerate, they feel didn't earn what they're getting.
Remember, these are older people who watched an African-American be elected president of the United States, which I frankly don't think most Americans thought that was going to happen. So they were surprised, but they were negatively surprised. I mean, the most important thing about them is that they're conservative. So they were upset that Democrats swept the 2008 elections, much the way that liberals in Cambridge, Massachusetts were upset when George Bush and Republicans were wall-to-wall in Washington, D.C. in 2000. So that phenomenon, political scientists know well, of when one party wins everything in Washington, the activists on the other side get angry and fearful and mobilize. Not surprising in a way. But here it has an edge of generational fear of a changing country, a country that's becoming browner, a country whose young people don't feel like they're behaving the same way you did. That's what we heard in the interviews. We heard fear as much as anger. Now, public events, you know, you see the angry signs. When you sit down with people, you realize that, as they will tell you, I'm afraid for the future of my country. That's how they put it. I want my country back.
You in a way, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you are taken by the extent to which the Tea Party is participatory democracy at work. These people organized their own meetings. They were using the communication tools of the Internet. These were people who were getting on the phones, hosting events, and so on. So on the one hand, you are impressed with participatory democracy at work, with their understanding of the process. We're going to elect this guy and then we're going to watch him. But on the other hand, you say they're completely ignorant or wrong about the ideas that they link to those processes.
Yeah, I'll make 2 points here. First, we concluded that the Tea Party was not one thing. So let's come back to that, because we see it as a weaving together of grassroots activism, which was quite genuine, with right-wing media cheerleading, as we put it, and a lot of attempts by wealthy right-wing billionaires to leverage this kind of activism for purposes they've been pursuing for a long time. But the bottom-up part of the Tea Party, the grassroots activism, one of our questions was, you know, are these people for real? I mean, where we did a web survey of, eventually with two Harvard undergraduates, and we documented the existence of 900 local Tea Parties. And we've got a map in the book that shows where they were. They're all over the United States. So one of our big questions was, who formed these Tea Parties? How did they do it? Did they just relabel previous groups, or were they new creations? And for the most part, new creations, and frankly, that's very impressive. In early 21st century America, for any entity, any movement to form almost 1,000 local groups that meet monthly, sometimes weekly, and depend mainly on volunteer energy and volunteer contributions, they're not getting checks from the Koch brothers at the local level. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to know how that happened. We learned a lot about it, and we were quite impressed. At the same time, a lot of the content of what was said in meetings or that people said to us in interviews was factually incorrect. Now, listen to the way I'm saying that. I'm not saying these are stupid people. In fact, they're not stupid people. They're actually pretty astute. They learned about the political process in a way that I was bowled over by. I mean, they would often know what was coming up at the local level, at their state legislature. They called bills by their numbers. Only political scientists do that. And they knew who to contact. They knew who to contact in a way that even liberals in Cambridge, Massachusetts are, you know, they often think politics consists of the president giving a speech and mentioning your issue. These people, much more savvy about, they would learn the rules of the Republican Party and descend on a local meeting and vote out the old boys and vote in the new Tea Partiers. They are good at the process of politics. But they believed things that were utterly amazing.
And what, in your analysis, what you and your co-author are showing is there is a bottom-up phenomena, but a top-down phenomena. Talk about that inner interface.
And that's where some of the false beliefs come from. Because, for example, when local Tea Partiers told us at one point that the government was preparing to come into our homes and take over the thermostats in all of our houses, Vanessa and I are thinking, well, where did this one come from? And so Vanessa went back and watched Fox News. Well, there it was on the Fox network. The Fox network has an older white conservative viewership. It is the primary source of news. We ask all of our people, where do you get your news? They all told, one guy smiled and said, where do you think? And told us that it was Fox and right-wing talk radio, which these people listen to 6 to 8 hours a day in many cases, especially the retirees. Well, they're getting utterly fantastic, conspiratorial, and false beliefs from that. And that's been documented in survey research, too. So that's part of it. And the other part of it is that there are, once the Tea Party broke out as a series of popular first demonstrations and then organizing these local Tea Parties, some longstanding ultra-free market advocacy groups like Freedom Works and Americans for Prosperity, groups that have been, they have big fancy offices, well-paid staffs. They've been pushing the idea that there should be no taxes on millionaires and billionaires, that there should be no regulation of government, that we shouldn't, that environmentalism is a hoax, global warming is a hoax. They've been pushing these ideas for a long time. But they either relabeled part of themselves the Tea Party, or they started, you know, appearing before cameras celebrating the grassroots activists or sending buses to take them to demonstrations. So they were leveraging this and leveraging it for purposes that include, by the way, privatizing the very Social Security and Medicare programs that the Tea Partiers themselves rely on. So we explore that irony of the convergence of the top-down and the bottom-up. And one of the main techniques that the top-down groups use to influence the local groups is to send speakers around that can be booked for free by local groups.
So there are two points here that are important. One is you point out that when this phenomena emerges at the grassroots, and things are hopping all over the countries, rallies, people in costumes, and so on, that the national media did not know who to talk to. And that at this point, when the national media becomes interested, they have to have spokesmen. So in addition to big right-wing money coming in to support these groups with ideas and money, additionally, suddenly national conservative organizations said, we will speak for them. And they're the ones who go on the tube and comment about what these people are really thinking.
Right. And we document that that happens increasingly over time. At first, as the local activism is breaking out, it's mainly Fox News telling people where they can go to hook up with a local Tea Party and putting a lot of cameras on these folks. Then by 2010, the mainstream media becomes utterly taken with this. I mean, after all, a bunch of older white people carrying signs denouncing Obama as a Nazi and a communist, that's photogenic. And they were beginning to influence elections, like the Scott Brown election in Massachusetts and the Marco Rubio finishing off of Crist in Florida. The mainstream media got, wanted pictures. But by the time you get to late 2010, and especially after that big election where the Republicans win so big with a lot of Tea Partiers involved, they want spokesmen. So guess who's there? Dick Armey, the head of FreedomWorks, who has he's a former Republican leader in Congress and a longtime wealthy lobbyist for right-wing business causes. He appoints himself a revolutionary and appears before the cameras speaking for what the grassroots wants, which it turns out is what his group has always been pushing.
Now, the second point that I think we need to emphasize is a point that you just made, which is there's a contradiction between what the right, big right-wing money wants and what these people actually believe. They believe they've earned their Social Security and their Medicare, and they don't want to take it, they don't want it turned into a voucher system, for example.
No, they don't. In fact, there have been national surveys, and, Tea Party identifiers are just about 10 percentage points behind all Americans in wanting to preserve Medicare, Social Security. They're maybe at the 70% level rather than the 80% level. That's not very significant. I would say that, that is a big tension. And one of the things we wondered is whether that would lead to a split. I would say it doesn't, partly because the grassroots don't control the top. The top doesn't directly control the bottom. So what you see politicians doing, and we should get to the Republicans here, is trying to speak to the primary concerns of both. And Mitt Romney's a very good example. In the primaries, he spoke to what is the most visceral, widely shared grassroots concern, which is hatred of immigrants, belief that many of them are undocumented and that they shouldn't get amnesty, they shouldn't get any benefits. Remember, he went after Rick Perry of Texas, said he was heartless. Perry said Mitt Romney was heartless for wanting to deny college access to children of undocumented, and Romney went after him, and the Tea Party cheered that on at the grassroots. And then Romney satisfies the right-wing billionaires by signing on to the Ryan plan to voucherize Medicare. And Ryan was also a leading supporter of privatizing Social Security.
But they put in the stipulation that it wouldn't affect people who are 55, which would relate to what you're
right,
saying.
Right, and I think that that's very important. I noticed that when the media started covering Paul Ryan, they didn't hone in on that crucial thing, which is they try to say it'll only affect people under 55. That, by the way, is not true, because once you take away Medicare and Social Security from people under 55, they're not going to want to keep paying the payroll taxes that sustain people into their 80s and 90s. So the whole thing would come apart very quickly. And, of course, Ryan and his supporters know that. But it's very carefully crafted to allow the Tea Party base to not get too riled up about it by saying to them, well, we're going to exempt people 55 and older. Most Tea Partiers, especially activists, are older than 50, and many older than 55.
Let's talk now about your Obama book, Obama and America's Political Future. You are attempting here to deal with the disappointment that progressives felt with what Obama accomplished, in his first term. And you do that by relying in part on an institutional analysis, saying it's very important to understand what's going on in the media, what's going on in the Republican Party, some of which we've just described, because the Tea Party essentially moved the Republican Party to the right. But thirdly, about what the state is like now and what progress looks like.
Yeah. I mean, everybody was so taken with the victory of Obama in 2008. And, of course, he arrived with congressional majorities in the House and the Senate for the Democrats. And you started seeing these depictions of him as the leader of a second New Deal, and a sort of an assumption that because there was an economic downturn, because he had these big majorities, and because he had campaigned saying he wanted to create a bottom-up economy rather than a top-down, and had talked about changing benefits and taxes, that he was going to be able to revolutionize American government the way Roosevelt did in the New Deal, and that would be combined with a rising political majority, because after all, he'd been supported by young people, minorities, the rising groups in American electoral politics. Well, 2 years later, we discovered that actually he had changed quite a bit, and I'll get back to that in a minute, but he wasn't getting the political payoff. So the motivation for the book was to ask what happened here. Did he really not change things the way he had said? Why was he not only enraging his opponents but disappointing many of his original supporters? And why didn't the political payoffs that you might expect go with the policy changes he did achieve, like health care reform?
And the bottom line here, you talk about the term, I think, is submerged state, basically, which comes from another analyst,
right.
Which is namely that, let's step back a minute, because where you want to start is with a comparison with Roosevelt.
Yeah.
And what you're saying is Roosevelt's project was different, although both projects are progressive, and it was in a different time where there were different institutions. And tell us a little about that.
So I'm using instead of talking about whether it was another New Deal or not in just descriptive terms, this grew out of the project that a bunch of us did together as well as my own work, looked at what it was like in the 30s for a reform-oriented Democrat to appear with big majorities in the middle of a economic crisis, and compare that to another time, 2008, when the same thing happened. And the purpose of the comparison was to clarify differences as well as to see what might be similar. So we noticed several things. I mean, the first and most important is the economic crisis itself. I mean, Roosevelt comes to the New Deal 3 years into the Great Depression, 25% unemployment, people from both political parties begging him to do something, and Congress passing the bills before they even got the written legislation in the early period. And that's because the crisis was so deep, so obvious, that the need for action was for at least a little while accepted by everybody across the spectrum. Look at Obama. He basically is holding hands with Herbert Hoover. I mean, he comes into office just at the very beginning of a financial meltdown that's going to lead to deep economic collapse and unemployment, high unemployment, but it hadn't yet. So he gets involved in trying to prevent it from turning into a second Great Depression. And that means he isn't reaping the sort of bipartisan support or the popular understanding of the need for many of the things he did. So that's one. And another, very different partisan context, hyper-partisan by the time he arrives. Media that include a right-wing media empire that can get out a message instantly while the rest of the media is fragmented and he can't get his message across. But you're pointing to the final thing, which is it's a big difference between putting in place major reforms in government for the first time. People can understand what you're doing. They may not support it, but they understand it. Versus trying to change the direction of an already massive federal government that has its finger in every sector of the economy and that is providing benefits to some and doing less for others. And so we do a lot with that comparison. I do a lot with that comparison.
And if you take healthcare, which you discuss, that's really an example of a problem set where you have vested interests who can be very loud in opposing and are obstacles, and on the one hand, and who you've got to deal with, make deals with, pay off in order to achieve your progressive goals. And all of this is done behind closed doors, you know, undercover in a way, because that's what the system has become.
Yeah, and, you know, healthcare is a very good example, college student loans, too. In both cases, you already have the federal government involved, usually by providing subsidies to private actors to give things to people. In the case of college loans, banks were subsidized to provide loans to college students. In the case of healthcare, apart from Medicare and Medicaid, which are government-run programs, a lot of the way the federal government has been involved in healthcare in the past has been to subsidize employers with tax breaks to get them to provide insurance coverage. Well, that had broken down. So Obama did campaign saying, I'm going to change these things. I'm going to give less to the privileged and squeeze out the resources in a fiscally constrained environment to give more to ordinary Americans, more loans, more grants to college students, more health care to the people who are uninsured, millions of them. 40 million or so by the time he came to office. But to do that, he had to design a very complex piece of legislation that could get through Congress that stepped on the toes of many vested interests in both cases who had the capacity to squawk. They knew what was happening. Hospitals knew if they were going to get less payments. Pharmaceutical companies knew if they were going to be getting less for their prescription drugs. The insurance companies, in particular, knew where this would challenge them. But most of the people who would eventually benefit, for example, from health care, millions, 30 million Americans going to get secure health care coverage. Most Americans are going to get a better deal from the insurance companies. They didn't know what they were eventually going to get. So Obama ended up looking like he was making a lot of dirty inside deals, the Cornhusker kickback to get Ben Nelson to vote for the thing, and the deals with Mary Landrieu in Louisiana. And it looked partisan, and it looked like an inside deal, and it looked complicated. The beneficiaries didn't know what it was because so many of the changes were in these complex regulations and tax breaks, and the opponents knew exactly what was happening. So that's part of the reason that you get the first 2 years resulting in a huge blowback from opponents and disappointment from many supporters who don't realize the enormity of the Obama administration's accomplishments.
And this gets at what we were talking about earlier, the contradiction in the American system, where the ideology of the country as a whole is in one place, but the reality is another. And it's bringing that truth to the American people so they realize how they're benefiting and then become supporters. But then you go on to say, interestingly enough, that in many ways, or at least in some ways, Obama failed as a communicator.
Yeah, he did. I mean, we do talk about the way in which the media environment has made it difficult, but particularly for economic policy. And remember, the big thing on Americans' minds by the time this president took office in January of 2009 was the plunging economy. And Republicans knew that they were going to be able to run against him and against Democrats in a down economy because of the enormity of the crisis. Obama and the Democrats sponsored the stimulus, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, but they didn't do a very good job of explaining what was in it, why it was expected to work, and that was an enormous failure. And that's a contrast to FDR, who even in the darkest moments of the Great Depression was always explaining. He was always explaining what he was trying to do and who was opposed to it. Obama was facing solid opposition from a Republican leadership that had decided that it wasn't going to cooperate in any of these recovery efforts because they wanted to defeat this president for re-election. And Obama kept trying to reach out to them long beyond the time it was realistic. But most of all, he never explained what was happening here. So I think a lot of ordinary Americans who were now learning in 2012 are willing to give him a lot of slack on this, are willing to say, well, maybe it did partly work and maybe we should stick with him. That's what's happening in this election. That could have happened earlier if only he had explained, and he didn't.
Did it surprise you that he couldn't communicate?
Yeah, I was surprised because, I mean, he obviously can communicate. The question is what happened to him. And the only analysis I can come up with is, first of all, he was overwhelmed with crises. I don't think there have been very many presidents who have arrived in Washington, D.C. with more on their plate because there's two wars, one of which he was trying to wrap up without a signing ceremony on the deck of a aircraft carrier or anything like that, Iraq, and another of which was fraught with peril.
And he has a very different relationship to war than Roosevelt did.
Yeah, absolutely.
The war helped Roosevelt get out of the Depression.
Yeah, and he was trying to wrap things up in these wars, or at least intensify Afghanistan in some ways and defeat terrorism in another. So it was just a series of crises he had to deal with. And then there's an economic meltdown, and he's a lawyer. He's a constitutional lawyer. I mean, I think he thought he needed people who understood Wall Street in order to both recover the economy and to change Wall Street and regulate it. And so he brought in economic advisors who, frankly, did do quite a bit. I mean, we can all criticize Larry Summers all we want, and I have a complicated personal relationship to him, but he did. They did take steps.
Not enough.
But they didn't focus on employment. They focused more on stopping the economic bleeding and the financial collapse. And I don't think that Obama had people telling him, first of all, that he should describe the new investments that were in the stimulus, in new energy sources, in job-creating infrastructure projects. He should have concretely stressed those things to voters so they could understand. And he should have talked about why government spending can help the private sector, because you can't assume that. That stuff that my father explained to me on the street in Wyandotte, Michigan when I was a child, Americans haven't heard any of that now for 20 years. So how would they know that government spending can actually help economic recovery? And you had the other side saying, this is exactly the wrong thing to do. Actually, I think they know it was the right thing to do, but they were going to say it was the wrong thing to do. And Obama didn't counter that. And I think that was a failure. He himself has admitted recently that it was a failure.
And he bought into the immediate problem is the deficit.
Bought into that a year later, and that is mind-boggling.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the side of Obama that wants to reach out to the other side.
Now, which leads me to a point. I guess one would have to conclude that running the country, if you can do that these days, is different than running the Harvard Law Review. And you know, it used to be said of Lyndon Johnson that he would say, let us reason together, but then he would squeeze you in a delicate place to get you to move. So stylistically, Obama has not evidenced that part of leadership.
Well, I that's to some degree true. I mean, I am not of the school of thought that we should be psychoanalyzing him. But, you're right, absolutely, that people's backgrounds do tell us something. I mean, it's both that he came from academia and that he's of his generation and that he understands that many Americans yearn for a cooperative style of politics. So these are genuine things that a lot of people want. And Obama does try that. He tries to bring people together and get them to lay out their ideas and then take some from every side. I don't think there's anything that's not admirable about that. I think in many ways it is admirable. And so the health care reform, for example, contains lots of Republican ideas. And I know many progressives, and I consider myself in my citizen capacity a progressive, would condemn that. I think, I'm not sure we should condemn it. I mean, it was a formula for a broadly, after all, it's Romney's health plan. So why not build something that could get broad support? But I don't think Obama was prepared for the cold-blooded ruthlessness and the extremism of the opposition he faced, which by the time the Tea Party was in the field was also something that Republicans were going to do for their own life, because they'd be offed in primaries if they didn't do it. And I don't think he reacted soon enough. He doubled down in that second year on cooperative efforts, and it almost did in his presidency because they almost sent the country into default.
You've taken in these two books the temperature of the right grassroots movement, and you've taken the temperature of the Obama administration and the progressive disappointment. I don't want you to predict the future. I don't think that's something you want to do. But I'm curious, what do you think we should watch for in the coming election that beyond the mistakes and errors of Mitt Romney, you know, with regard to these big issues pointing to the country's future after the election?
Well, what we should watch for is a good way to put it. That's what historical institutional analysis, which is what I do, can tell you. It can't – any social scientist who ever tells you that he or she can predict the future is blowing smoke. I know a lot of them do, but they're blowing smoke. What we can do is tell you what factors are in play and what the alternative possibilities are. So the analysis that I've done, which has been not just about Obama and the grassroots Tea Party, but about what's happened to the Republican Party, which, by the way, has moved to the right the furthest in quantitatively recorded measurements in political science for 50 years. It's a breathtakingly radical party at this point. That means that this election is one of the most pivotal in American history. It's as simple as that. Should this radicalized Republican Party succeed in taking the presidency and both houses of Congress at once, they will dismantle 20th century social policy within 3 months. And they know it's not popular, but they'll do it anyway. And so if that happens, we're going to be seeing on the road to privatizing Social Security and Medicare, we're going to see two-thirds of the cuts in the Ryan budget are aimed at America's already ungenerous programs for the poor. We're going to see devastating suffering on top of the terrible hit that lower-income and middle-income people, frankly, have taken in this Great Recession. We're going to see disinvestment in education, research. The federal government slated to be cut to 50% of its level at the end of at the high point after World War II. These are incredible changes, and many of them will be carried through very fast with no worry about any filibusters in the Senate. They'll just do it. So that's one possibility. Now, another possibility is that Obama's reelected. He has shown considerable fight, by the way, in the last year. So lest we say that this man has no toughness in him, I actually think when pushed against the wall by people he's reached his hand out to have slapped it away, he's one of the toughest. The Obama campaign has been run ruthlessly because they're working to reelect a president in an economic slowdown, and they know it. And they know the stakes. So they have not played pussyfoot in this election. If he's reelected, he's going to have to deal with at least one House of Congress that's under radicalized Republican right-wing control, and he's going to try once again to come up with bargains on taxes and spending. He's going to be in a stronger position for two reasons. One, he will have been reelected, which is going to cause a war in the Republican Party that I expect to last for about 6 to 8 years because they won't be able to believe it. And secondly, he'll be in a stronger position because the tax cuts that have taken such a huge bite out of federal government resources, the Bush tax cuts, are going to expire by law. So deadlock means they go away rather than deadlock meaning that conservatives get what they want. So Obama will be able to say, here's what I'm prepared to bring back in the way of tax cuts. Here's what I'm willing to change in spending programs going forward. You have to give on tax increases for the rich, or they're going to happen anyway. That puts him in a better position.
Well, on that note, we really appreciate your coming on our program and sharing your
Thanks
insights,
for having
both,
me.
both about the Republicans and the Democrats. Thank you, Professor Sajjan. And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.